Very good morning. Let us turn to 1 Samuel chapter 20. It's a rather longer passage that we have read this morning as we finish up this chapter before us from verse 18 all the way down to verse 20. And the topic that I'd like to have this morning is seeing God amid adversity. Right, seeing God amid adversity. You know, there are certain times in our lives, certain events that may happen in our lives that we would describe as adversity. Difficult times, tough times, trials that happen, maybe even calamities that befall upon us. Whether it's to do with our health, our safety, maybe our jobs, our livelihoods, perhaps maybe some natural disasters that happen, really throw a spanner, as it were, in the works and disrupt our lives completely. I don't know if you know, if you remember, quite a number of years ago, I think it was in the early 2000s, that there was this tsunami that struck, right? It was sort of almost a global event, you know, these huge waves swept through much of, you know, Asia, you know, countries like Sri Lanka, Thailand, and they were very, very badly affected. And, you know, it did send literally and figuratively shockwaves throughout the world. And it is during that time that the Archbishop of Canterbury, and he's supposed to be the leader of, you know, all of the Anglicans in the world, he wrote this article. And within that article, he wrote, right, he wrote this statement, or, you know, he remarked in this way. He says, the question, how can you believe in a God who permits suffering on this scale, is therefore very much around at the moment. And it will be surprising if it weren't. Indeed, it will be wrong if it weren't. And that's quite a troubling statement to make for a person who was supposed to be the leader of so many Christians, so many churches throughout the world, to then make a question which really sort of hints or implies that, you know, when these things happen, when adversity strikes, you know, our faith should be shaken, that we should be led to question, why, God, would you allow such a thing to happen? And yes, it's true, it was definitely a calamity. Millions of people's lives were affected. Many, many people died. But it is precisely amidst adversity that it should not turn us away from God or lead us to question God. But rather, faith enables us to see that truly, indeed, God is there. And that in the midst of adversity, that should all the more lead us to run to the Savior and not away from Him. And that is what we see here, you know, as Jonathan and David grapple with this adversity that is before them. I mean, it was a very difficult time for both of them. Right? David was about to begin life as a fugitive. He had done nothing wrong. I mean, all this while, as we have been studying his life, he had done nothing but contribute to the nation of Israel, the kingdom of Israel. He had played the harp for Saul. He had slain the champion of the Philistines, and in so doing, really delivered Israel as a nation from the scourge of, you know, being enslaved by a foreign nation, by a foreign power. He had saved Israel from the Philistines. And then after that, he had been assigned, you know, as a captain in Saul's army. He was a leader of men, and he had gone and, you know, participated in many conquests, many military expeditions, and, you know, he had brought nothing but to serve faithfully. But because of that, Saul had been very threatened by him. And Saul was now becoming increasingly unstable, and he really wanted to murder David, and he had made numerous attempts on his life. And because of that, Saul, David had now to go on the run. He had to leave his wife behind, Michal. And now he was to determine, does Saul really want to murder me? Or is it just momentary periods of instability? They were not fully certain yet, but by the end of this chapter, they would. And what meant was David's life was about to change completely. He could no longer enter into the palace. It would not be safe for him. And from here onwards, he would be a fugitive on the run. The whole nation, all of the armies, the soldiers of Saul will be out hunting for him and going to kill him, seeking to kill him. That was the adversity that David was facing. I mean, Jonathan, in his own way, it was not any better. Because David was telling him that your father has murderous intent. He wants to kill me. For Jonathan, he was struggling to come to terms with that. He was still trying to reconcile this in his heart, and he says, no, I spoke to my father. He agreed not to kill you, right? He has seen the error of his ways. And yes, in the previous chapter at the start, Saul did tell Jonathan that, yes, I'm wrong. I've sinned. I shouldn't be killing David. But yet David was saying another thing, a different story. David was telling him, no, your father really does want to murder me. It is not safe for me. And so he had to come to terms with the fact that his own father, his king, is a killer. He's a murderer who wants to kill his best friend. And that was adversity in itself as well. But yet, through this very difficult period, if you examine the text before us, right, from verse 18 all the way into the end of the chapter, we will see that in their conversation, in the things that they do, God is very much front and center in their lives. You see, this adversity that they are facing does not cause them to turn away from God, but rather to seek refuge from God. And to all the more so have to cling tight to their faith and to know that no matter what happens, God is there, God is present. And that is exactly how we need to respond as well. To have a God-centered life. And really, what does that mean? It means that no matter what happens, God must and continue remain to be our refuge and our strength. Right? That's what we read in the Psalm just now, right? Psalm 46. It's a Psalm of David. Right? A Psalm that he penned later as he will be on that run. And he will speak of how, yes, you know, though the mountains roar, the earth be removed, though everything around him seems to collapse and fall apart, but God is my refuge and my strength, my very present help, my time of need. And he says, be still and know that I am God. That ought to be the response of every true believer. That in the midst of adversity, it is not that we should question God and wonder, oh, why does God allow these things to happen and to allow our faith to be shaken? No. We must see God amid all adversity that we face. And so whatever it is that happens, if tomorrow morning you receive a call from your doctor and you have a diagnosis saying, oh, there is some sort of terminal sickness for you or your family or your loved ones, what will our response be? Will we straight away question and say, God, why do you allow that to happen? Be angry with God, well, all the more so to turn to Him, to run to Him, and to find comfort and solace in this Almighty God that we worship. So it's a very long passage before us. It's a narrative. It's, you know, telling us the story of what happened. But I really want to zoom in, right, on a particular few things that David and Jonathan will say and do, right? That highlights really the fact that they are able to see God in the midst of everything that was going on. Now, the first thought, the first point I want to raise is, you know, how to see God amid adversity. Firstly, you must recognize God's providence, His sovereign providence in our lives. And we see that from the ongoing conversation between David and Jonathan. Right, so last Lord's Day, we looked at the first part or first section of this chapter, where, yes, it was that conversation, and they were trying to ascertain, right, what was going on. And so from verse 18 onwards, they enact a plan, or rather Jonathan agrees to go ahead with the plan that David had made, right? So earlier on, David had given Jonathan these instructions to say, well, you know, I will be away from this feast of the new moon, and in the meantime, you know, you will do a little bit of investigation, so to speak, for me, right? Saul will ask where I am, and depending on his response, then we will know, right, what Saul's intention is. Now here, Jonathan adds one more layer to that, and he adds this precaution. And so while he may not have fully come to terms or been convinced that Saul is really out to get him, yet he says, now, if it is true, and he says, I know my father, if it is true that Saul really wants to kill you, then he will leave no stone unturned. And if it is true that he wants to kill you, it will become very, very dangerous. And so they made a plan, right? As he goes in and finds out what is going on, they make this sort of a secret code words, right, that they would have in order to communicate to David as to what is the truth of the matter. And it was a precaution that they were taking, right? That if really Saul wants to murder you, it is likely that after the events of the next 3 days, you know, even Jonathan himself might be followed. There may be spies all around. And so we need to send these secret messages in order for us to be able to communicate with each other. Okay, so that's why they agree on all these things, right? So he says, you know, after 3 days, what's going to happen, when I will know. Okay, so you hide here. 3 days, I'm going to come out to this field. Okay, and so the arrangement is that I will shoot 3 arrows, all right, as though, you know, I'm doing target practice, I'm aiming at something, and I will have a lad with me, sort of a servant boy, right, a young man who will be his assistant, and depending on what I say to him, then you will know the state of affairs. Okay, so 2 possibilities. One is that I say that the arrows are on this side of thee, take them. So basically he's saying, you know, I will shoot the arrows, the boy runs out, and then when I tell the boy, all right, the arrows are here, it's over this side, that's a signal to show that it is safe. So your fears are unfounded, you can come out, right? You know, Saul does not want to murder you. So that's the first possibility. The second possibility is that if I say the arrows are beyond thee, I mean to say the arrows are over there. So basically, the arrows are here, arrows are there, right? That the arrows are further beyond thee, far away, and that's the signal to say that your life is in danger. You will have to be on the run. But the focus that I want to really have is the words of Jonathan here in verse 21 and verse 22. That no matter what the outcome is, these 2 possibilities, right? Whether Saul wants to take your life or whether Saul is okay with you, in both instances, he mentions the Lord, right? And so he says, firstly, if Saul is not intent on killing you, there is peace and no hurt, as the Lord liveth. Now, what's the meaning of the phrase, as the Lord liveth? So he's basically saying, as true as, you know, Jehovah is the one and true living God, right? That as long as Jehovah lives, which is forever, right? I mean, Jehovah is definitely the one true living God. And so what he's basically doing is sort of invoking the name of God to say that certainly, most definitely so. And I pledge my word, as long as God is alive, that there shall be no hurt that will come upon you. There is peace for you. Okay? And so in a way, he's saying he's calling God to be the witness here. That if so be that I go and I find out that there is no harm upon you, well, God is my witness, and God surely, you know, by his grace and through his mercies, will ensure that you will be able to come in peace and there will be no hurt upon you. But then he says, if, right, the signal is the arrows are beyond thee. He says, go thy way, for the Lord hath sent thee away. Again, this is a recognition of God's presence and God's providence in their lives. And basically saying that if your life is in danger, then you're not safe here any longer. You have to flee. And so again, remember, you know, Saul, Jonathan did not know how things would pan out, and he wouldn't know how safe things would be, whether they are able to meet and communicate and talk about it. And so he had to send this signal. And it could very well be, although it was not the case, but it could very well be that these would have been the final words that Jonathan would get to say to David. But what is the key thing he wants to point out or highlight? He wanted to remind his friend that even if it is so that you have to be on the run, and then you have to flee, and we may never ever have to meet again, and the rest of your life or the rest of the time in which my father is alive, he will be trying to kill you, but yet, this is the Lord's doing. You realize that, verse 22? It is the Lord that has sent thee away. So it's not Saul. It's not Saul's armies or Saul's soldiers. It is the Lord. But you see, that is a recognition of providence. You see, that is the understanding of a man of faith. To know that no matter what happens, and even though this situation, of course, it was not ideal, I mean, it was a very bad situation for David, right? To realize or to find out that your king and your father-in-law, by the way, and the father of your best friend wants to murder you, and yet he's able to say, the Lord is the one that has sent you away. But you see, that is faith. Faith is recognizing that no matter what it is that happens in our lives, whether it is what we will regard as blessings or good things, good tidings, good things that happen in our lives, or if it is calamity, adversity, trial, hardship, the Lord has sent us on that way. Because the Lord is the one that directs our paths. Right? The Lord is the one that guides us everywhere and every way that we go. He is the one guiding our footsteps, guiding our path the way that we should go. And you see, faith, or seeing God amidst adversity, is recognizing that fact. Because a lack of faith would lead us to then question, right? If David did not have that understanding, if Jonathan did not have that understanding, it could be tempted to ask, now why, God, did you allow this to happen? How could you allow my father to go down this path? God, is all your fault. But they didn't say that. And neither should we. When calamity falls, he says, why, God, did you allow these things to happen? And some of us sitting here may be grappling with some of these very issues. I don't know how many of you have been directly impacted, right, by some of the global events that are happening around the world. It's why, God, did you allow war to break out? And every day you read the newspapers, you're waiting for them to declare peace. But things just seem to be getting worse and worse, escalations. And you're wondering, when is it going to end? I don't know how many of you are affected by the recent budget announcements. And there was a lot of, conversation, talk going on. How is this going to affect people's livelihoods, small businesses, property owners, or whatever it is, your situations are? Does it affect you positively, negatively? And again, people will be very bitter and angry and upset. And, a natural, though not right, but an instinctive response that many people have to bad news is that we will murmur and complain. We'll become angry and frustrated. What is the government doing? What is the government thinking? Whether it is, remote events happening all around the world, or maybe things immediately in your vicinity, right? Whatever struggle it is that you're going through, can we see the hand of God working? Will your response be, yes, the Lord has given, the Lord has taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord? Or are we tempted to question God, to blame God, to doubt God? as it seems even what the Archbishop of Canterbury was saying. What is our response? And for Jonathan, you know, his was an encouraging word to his friend. He says, go. Yes, it is bad news, but the Lord hath sent thee away. And as a man that recognizes and understands God's hand working in our lives, similar response, and I mentioned this many times, of how Joseph was able to see his life in retrospect, right? Recognizing that, yes, it was a terrible thing what his brother had done, but nonetheless, God is the one that sent me here in order to preserve many alive. You thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good. And it may have been hard for David to recognize this at this point of time. But those years of adversity, those years in which he was on the run, you know, these were some of the most fruitful years of David's life. You know, these were times in which he really drew near to the Lord. He penned many of his most wonderful psalms during this time of hardship. Psalm 46 that we read just now. And God willing, in a couple of Lord's days, we're going to see some of the psalms. Right? We saw one, I think, about three, four weeks ago. And we're going to see more, right, of these psalms that he wrote during this time of hardship, where it was precisely in his time of greatest desperation that he drew close to the Lord. And sometimes we need that. Sometimes, you know, when things are comfortable and we are cruising along, we forget God, we forsake God. And perhaps it is necessary, needful, that God places us through certain difficult times, and that's the time that we draw close to the Lord. And we read the Psalms, and it resonates with us. We understand, because perhaps we are going through similar things. And that is the grace of God. That is the mercy of God, and how he draws us back unto himself. And so for David, that was the message that Jonathan had for him, and help him perhaps to come to terms with things also, to recognize, yes, this is God's hand working in his life. And so that's the first thought, right? To recognize God's sovereign providence. Now, secondly, I'll describe this as to understand man's depravity. To understand man's depravity. What do I mean by that? Depravity really describes the sinfulness of men, right? The depths of immorality and the depths of sin that people sadly can sometimes descend into. Because a lot of times when we go through adversity, it could be because it is at the hand of someone else. And there are very wicked people in this world, very sinful people, very immoral people, right? People with no moral compass, and they could do anything as long as it gets themselves ahead, right? And so they're very, very, very terribly selfish people. And they have no qualms about causing great inconvenience or even great destruction in the lives of other people as long as they get ahead, as long as they get away. And sometimes we may have to encounter with such people, malicious people, selfish people. And they may be people that go out of their way to cause you harm and trouble. They may literally rob you, right, of your livelihoods. You may fall prey to certain scams, and your life savings are wiped out. And we become very troubled by these things. And again, that may lead us to question God. Is why didn't God protect me? Why didn't God care? Why did he allow me to encounter such terrible, malicious, selfish people? But you see, when these things happen again, we have to understand that that is simply the nature of man. That is sin, and that is the reality of sin, which is what now Jonathan has to come to terms with, right? Remember, this man was his father. This man was his king. This man was the one who raised him. But yet, now he will have to be met with the reality that this man is a murderer. And so he did as David asked him to do. He went and attended the feast of the new moon. And the king was there and sat down to eat. And initially, he didn't say anything. He probably assumed maybe, you know, something has happened to David. Maybe he is ceremonially unclean and therefore he's not here for the feast. But then on the second day, David's place was still empty. And so he asked Jonathan, where is this man? Where is David? Right, verse 27, he says, wherefore cometh not the son of Jesse to meat? Yesterday he wasn't here, and today he's not here either. And so he gives the line that David asked him to say that, well, he has asked leave to go to Bethlehem, and therefore he is not here. It was at that, verse 30, that Saul's anger was kindled against Jonathan. And he said some pretty harsh words, terrible words, actually. He basically cursed him with pretty vulgar statements. Right? What did he say? He said unto him, thou son of the perverse, rebellious woman, do you not know that thou hast chosen the son of Jesse to thine own confusion and unto the confusion of thy mother's nakedness? Now, what is he basically saying here? I mean, this woman, who is his mother, was also his wife, right? So Saul was cursing his wife. But what was he implying by this statement? He's saying that you are the son of the perverse, rebellious woman. He's implying that, you know, you are taking after your mother. That when you side with the son of Jesse, so you notice he's sort of invoking lineage into his argument here. He says, you are siding with the son of Jesse. And he's saying, I don't recognize you as my son any longer. You are your mother's son. And your mother is, as it were, a perverse and rebellious woman. And you are taking after her, not me. Right? He's saying, I am the good one here. I am trying to protect you and preserve your bloodline and your claim as heir to the throne. And you are siding instead David. David is not my son. David is the son of Jesse. And how dare you side him? And in doing so, it is like you are not mine. He is, in a sense, disowning Jonathan, that you are son of that perverse, rebellious woman. Not to say that he actually believes that she did commit adultery, but he is, as it were, implying that spiritually, so to speak, that's what she has done. Right? Because when you do so, it is to the confusion, or the word confusion has the idea of shame. It is like you are proving the shame of your mother's nakedness, that she is perverse, that she has, as it were, slept with another man, and you are the product of that. Not that he really believed that, but it was an insult to say that you are like an illegitimate son to me. And that's what he was implying. That you have brought my family, you have brought shame to this family. I do not recognize you as my son. You are just the son of that woman. And so in one sentence, he's both insulting Jonathan, he's insulting his wife. But that is the extent of madness and rage that he had descended into. Where he was just blinded by this whole situation. And all he was concerned about is getting rid of David, whom he now recognized or thought of as his enemy. He is the one that is coming to challenge my claim on the throne, and he's going to take my son's place on the throne. But Jonathan, what are you doing? I'm trying to protect you, but you are helping, colluding with the enemy. And so Saul's anger against David was now directed to Jonathan as well. And so it's a confusing thing, I know. On one hand, he's trying to protect Jonathan's claim to the throne, but at the same time, he is now enraged that Jonathan does not care for that, and he's helping the enemy, and therefore he turns around and he wants to kill Jonathan as well. I mean, that is the destructive nature of what anger can do. He was so just blinded by his rage. And now he takes up a javelin, a spear, and he tries to throw it at Jonathan. I mean, that was a sad situation that he was in now. I mean, Jonathan went in trying, hopefully, to prove his father's innocence. But instead, what was he met with? His father's depravity. I mean, it's a terribly difficult thing to have to come to terms with, isn't it? A man whom he probably looked up as a child, as any son would to a father, with deep respect, regarding him even as a hero. And then to see that, well, my father was crowned king, and my father was able, in his earlier years at least, to lead our people and to win battles on the battlefield. He fought alongside Saul. Right? He was a soldier in Saul's army. He was a trusted confidant of Saul. But now Saul turns around and he says such terrible, terrible things against him. And then he says, what are you doing? Fetch David unto me. He shall surely die. In no uncertain terms. Right? He sees the true colors of Saul. And Saul is saying, you go bring your friend to me. I want to kill him. Right? Just early on, he was trying to defend his father before David. And he says, no, I don't think that's what he really wants to do. No, he has promised me, he has told me that he's not going to kill you. And now Saul tells him directly, no, I do want to kill him. Bring him here. He must die. And it's a terribly difficult thing to come to terms with. Right? And that was his adversity. To realize that his father was truly, really a very wicked state here, that he wants to kill him. And so he tries to defend David one last time. He says, why? Verse 32, why should he be slain? What has he done? And instead of replying, he throws a spear at him. What was Jonathan to do? I mean, he had to make a choice, right? He could no longer afford to be neutral. He could no longer in good conscience defend Saul any longer. He has to, forced to make that choice between righteousness and his relationship. I mean, we saw that earlier on when he defended or spoke on behalf of David. Now, it is more than just words. It is action. What will you do? Will you follow and listen to your father's instructions? Bring me here. He shall surely die. Or will you defy your father and, as it were, break ties with him? I mean, it's clear his father is in the wrong. Right, his father is trying to murder an innocent man. And so the lines of separation now have to be drawn. Which will he choose? And he has to realize that his father is in sin. His father is in the wrong. And he's now confronted with really the depths of depravity that his own father had descended into. I mean, you know what sort of justification it would take for a person to say that another person deserves to die, to murder someone, right? And it was an innocent man. It was as what Jonathan was saying here, without cause. There's no good reason why he should die. I mean, previously he had spoken more extensively about that, right? That he had done nothing but to serve you well. He has been faithful. Why does he deserve to die? And now he reiterates that. He says, what has he done? What has he done to deserve death? But that is the depths of depravity that Saul had fallen into. So blinded by that single fixation on, well, I must get rid of David to defend my throne. And that's all he cared about. He was just concerned about himself, his claim to the throne. Righteousness, God's will, God's desire, all these things did not matter to him. Right? The fact that, Samuel had already prophesied of this to him, that now your kingdom will not continue. The fault is not with David. The fault is with Saul. He has sinned and he has to repent. But he didn't care for that. He just wanted to try to take matters into his own hands, get rid of the competition, and thinking that through that, his kingdom can continue. But you see, when we are faced with these things, again, how do we respond? Are we discouraged? Do we despair? And we wallow in self-pity and think, now, why are these people so wicked, so terrible? I mean, yes, that is part of the story. And Jonathan was rightly angered by this. And you see that in the following verses. That, after David took that spear and cast it at Jonathan, verse 34 says, Jonathan arose from the table in fierce anger and did not eat no meat in the second day of the month, for he was grieved for David because his father had done him shame. And so he was sad, of course, understandably very upset. that everything that David had said was true, even though he didn't want to believe it, he had, you know, the facts were clear before him, right? Saul was a murderer, and Jonathan had no choice but to admit that. But, you know, the reality of things is that this is something that Jesus has warned us of repeatedly also. That in this world, we will have adversity, and a lot of times it may or it will come at the hand of others. And that is what Jesus told his disciples, right? Think not that I'm come to send peace, but I come to send a sword. And one of the effects or one of the outcomes of you following Christ, of believing in the gospel, is that sometimes it may be that, and Jesus says, I'll have to set man at variance against his father and against his daughter, against a mother, a daughter-in-law, against a mother-in-law. And foes shall they be of his own household. And Jesus is saying, you see, that is the outcome of when people reject the gospel, when people reject God. Sometimes it will result in conflicts even within the home, where blood ties will just not be enough, because your allegiance will have to be to Christ and to God. And when, you know, the other people in your family do not follow along with that, what we see is that it, you know, extend the depths of depravity, of what rebelliousness really entails. And so Jesus laid that down. He says, he that loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. He that loveth son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And there'll be times in which we are forced to make that choice. But you see, again, that should not cause us to run away from God, but to realize that, yes, God is more precious than all these things. And it may be that we are confronted with the depravity, even of those closest to us. Now, of course, it doesn't mean that we give up on them. It doesn't mean that we forsake them completely. No, we continue to pray for them. We continue to seek to witness to them and to try to bring the gospel to them. But yet the reality of things is that some of these things may sometimes happen. People around you, even closest to you, may betray you. And that could be very well the calamities that you are going through also. If you betrayed, you feel abandoned, you felt that perhaps there was a loss of trust. And they may react, and that may result, right, in certain difficulties or hardship that you are going through. A loved one, a sibling, a parent, a spouse. And you say, what is going on? Again, all the more so, we turn to God. We find solace in Him. Because that is what Jesus warned us also. In John chapter 16, that's what He told His disciples. He says, these things have I spoken unto you, that ye should not be offended, that you should not be stumbled, you should not be troubled. Oh, they will put you out of synagogues. Yea, the time comes that whosoever kills you will think that he does God's service. And that is the reality of the times that we're living in today. People are sinful, people are rebellious, and we may face adversity at the hands of these sort of people. People who kill us or who trouble our lives, and they think that they are doing good. They think that they are doing the right thing. Jesus says, these things have I spoken unto you, that you will not be troubled, you will not be offended. And these things will they do, and they will continue to do. There will be increasing persecution, there will be increasing injustice. As the world descends deeper and deeper into depravity, Jesus warned, right, that just before I come, it will be like in the days of Sodom and Gomorrah. They will be doing all sorts of terrible things. That's how the world will be like. It will be like in the days of Noah, where you go and preach the gospel, people laugh in your face, they will not believe you. And they say, what nonsense are you talking about? What, Jesus is coming again? You go and believe in your superstition. No, I will continue to enjoy life. I mean, that is the reality of the world around us that we are living in. There will be increasing sin and depravity that we see around us. But we must still be able to see God amidst this adversity. That no matter what it is that man can do against us, it did not shake Jonathan's faith. Instead, as we will see later on, he continues to see God in the midst of everything that is going on. And so with that, he has to fulfill his end of the bargain. He has to inform David of what is taking place. And so the message is now very clear. David's life is most certainly in danger. Of course, he will not betray David, but he will help David in his escape. And that's what we see from verse 35 onwards. All right? So the third point that we want to see now, how do we find God amid adversity? All right, firstly, we recognize his sovereign providence. Right? Recognize the fact that he's in control. And no matter what happens, God is the one that sends us on our way. Secondly, that we understand the reality of depravity. Right? We understand that man can be terribly sinful, but that should not discourage us. But thirdly, when that happens, we find comfort amongst God's people. And that's what we see David and Jonathan doing, right? And that's from verse 35 to verse 41. We find comfort amongst God's people. So who are they to turn to? So both of them, of course, were in much adversity. Jonathan has just come to terms with the fact that his father is a bad person, a murderer. David will now be informed that his life is not going to be the same again. He's going to have to be on the run. And so that message is communicated through that pre-arranged signal. So Jonathan goes out to the field and he starts to shoot arrows. And then he tells his lad to go, run, find the arrows which I shoot. And so he shoots an arrow that he knows will land far beyond where the boy is. So he's able to say, is not the arrow beyond thee? Right, verse 37. And so that was a prearranged signal as you compare that with verse 22. So he already told David beforehand, right? If I say to the young man, look, behold, the arrows are beyond thee, go thy way, for the Lord has sent thee away. So the message to David is, this is the message that you must flee. You must run away. Your life is in danger. Okay? But as I mentioned earlier, Jonathan, when they made this signal, they didn't know how things will be. They did not know how dangerous it would be, right? Whether Jonathan will be surrounded by guards or soldiers, whether Saul will be in the vicinity, they didn't know, right? And that's why they had to make this prearranged signal. But it seems that by Jonathan's estimation, he knew what was happening. He knew whether he was followed out. He knew whether, you know, Saul's spies were around him. And so he assessed the situation, and perhaps the only other witness was the lad. And so he told the lad to go, right? He says he gave the artillery, verse 40, that means all the arrows and the equipment, he gave it to the boy and says, go, carry them to the city. So he dismissed him. And as soon as the lad was gone, Jonathan realized that, okay, it's safe enough. We can meet one brief, final moment before David, you have to go on the run. Okay? Because you may read this whole chapter and think, it's a bit strange, right? Well, I mean, why go through all this trouble and then they actually can meet? I mean, couldn't he just meet him and tell him what's going on and says, okay, it's not safe, go. Now, all these things were a precaution, right? It was a precaution which, you know, Jonathan, by his estimation, realized that, okay, it seems that it's safe enough for us to meet briefly before he goes off, okay? So all these things were not unnecessary. But it was just their, you know, the precautions that they took in case things go south and, you know, the whole place is swarming with soldiers and they had to have a secret code, a way to signal to David that, okay, it's not safe, you better run. But that was not the case, right? And that's why they were able to meet one final time in verse 41. So as soon as the lad was gone, David arose out of a place, and he fell on his face to the ground and bowed himself three times, as it were, to, you know, thank his friend, but also perhaps that was just a way of that final farewell. They were overwhelmed with emotion and grief. And again, you know, I mentioned this a number of times, it was a most unlikely pairing. Because the very reason why David had to go on the run was because Saul was trying to defend the throne for Jonathan, right? And the reason why, you know, Saul was angry and all that was because of this man, David. They were supposed to be enemies, rivals, right? Fighting for the throne, which, you know, David, which Saul was fighting so hard to preserve. But of course, in this most unlikely pairing, they were drawn together. Right? Despite all the circumstances, they saw in each other kindred spirit. That both of them loved the Lord, and their chief concern, right, really was to do the right thing before the sight of the Lord. And so, despite the risks that they could have, that was involved in having this final meeting, they felt that they needed to comfort each other during this time, because who else could they turn to? They were both alone, right? Saul's father wanted to kill him. Sorry, Jonathan's father, Saul, wanted to kill him. David had to run away from even his wife. And so they found solace one with another. And it must have been a most precious moment of comfort and respite. Right before, you know, David's life changed completely. He would have to be on the run, and Saul's armies would be, you know, chasing him, trying to kill him. And it was a time that, you know, they were both alone, there was nowhere to turn to, and that friendship was so precious and so important, right? And so, you know, he cried, "Make haste, Jonathan," right? "Stay not." Although it was a message to the lad, that was probably words for David to hear also. As heartbreaking as it was for Jonathan to say so, he had to send his friend away. He says, "Go. It's not safe for you to stay here any longer." And so they had that final farewell. And while we are not, no, we don't know all of the words that they spoke at this point of time, surely, right? Surely it was a time where they encouraged one another in the Lord. And this will be the second last meeting that they will have. They will have one final opportunity to meet very, very briefly, right? Later on, I believe in chapter 23, if I'm not wrong. Or 24, they will have that very brief moment where they will meet, and that's it. The next time will be the news of Jonathan's death. But nonetheless, what we have, you know, in the company of God's people, you know, in the midst of our trials, our difficulties, stressful times, it is the encouragement that we can have, right? That solace that we can seek one with another. When the Bible in Proverbs 17:17 tells us, a friend loves at all times, brother is born for adversity. And that is what Saul was to Jonathan was to David, David was to Jonathan. And we explored this quite a lot, right, in True Biblical Friendship. We talked about that earlier on. Talked about the friendship of David and Jonathan, and here we see it being reiterated one final time. And that's oftentimes what we need as well. As much as, yes, we recognize the hand of God working in our lives, we need the encouragement one of another also. As we go through difficult times, adversities, you know, we can find spiritual refreshment. We can find spiritual encouragement in the company one of another. And we must seek to be that friend, right? Recognize that sometimes, you know, there are people around you that are going through very, very hard times. And a word spoken at that point of time can be a very, very precious thing. For Ecclesiastes tells us, right, two are better than one. Right? If they fall, one will lift up the fellow. But woe to him that falleth, that is alone when he falls, for he hath not help another one to help him. And we should be on the lookout for these brothers and sisters in Christ that are potentially going to fall, and we can be the one to lift them up. We can be that brother born for adversity. And so you be that friend, and you have that sort of friends, you cherish that friend, because that can be that lifeline that helps you out of your adversity. And then finally, I'll describe this final point as be assured of God's presence. In verse 23, Jonathan mentioned this once, and then he mentions it again in verse 42. What is it? What is he talking about? He's referring to the matter which thou and I have spoken of, right? And then here he speaks that for as much as we have sworn, both of us, in the name of the Lord be between me and you, between your seed and my seed. What is this matter which they have spoken of previously? Well, he's referring to the pledge that he asked of David in verse 14 of this same chapter, right? And that is recognizing the fact that, David, you're going to be king one day. And usually when a king comes to power, he would murder the rest of the previous royal family, because that is his way of securing his throne. He cannot have challengers to the throne running around the kingdom. And so typically, that's what a king would do. Remember, this was the first royal family of Israel. And so they had no other pattern to follow than what the surrounding nations would usually do. And so their understanding of a monarchy is this, that if there is a change of the dynasty, the throne passes from the house of Saul to the house of David. A usual king would then murder everyone left from the house of Saul. And so Jonathan was concerned about that. Not to think that he thought of his friend as a murderer, but perhaps, you know, that is what he expected to happen, and maybe that is what his advisors would advise him to do, right? David, now that you are king, come, we will get rid of the house of Saul. After all, Saul has been your enemy, right? All this while, Saul has been trying to kill you, and now that you are king, we got to deal conclusively with the house of Saul. And so Jonathan wanted to ensure that that would not happen, and so he pleaded with his friend, please be merciful to us. I will support you to be king, but please protect my family. And David, of course, agreed to that. But yet, before they went, you know, Jonathan wanted to be assured of that. And so again, he invoked the name of the Lord. And so he didn't come at this as a threat, right? But just as a reminder, right? To reiterate the covenant and the promise that they had made one with another. And he said all these things. He said, right, that concerning that matter, the Lord be between me and you forever. And it's not a threat, right? But he's saying it as a way of actually maybe even a comfort and assurance. That as much as we are now departing and we may not see each other ever again, but the Lord is here and the Lord continues to be between us or with us, right? And that though we be physically apart, we are drawn together or tied together by the bonds of Christ, by this covenant that we have agreed to. And he sends his friend away, yet with the assurance that you will take care of my family. And that's actually, again, a very precious thing to remember, right? That yes, we are apart, and we may never ever get a chance to see each other ever again. But he sends him away knowing that, David, you will become king and all will be well with you. That even though you have to be on the run for a season, God will take care of you. And it is likely that you're going to outlive me, and therefore take care of my family. Take care of my family. And in that, you know, he didn't just say, you take care of my family. He said, the Lord be between you and me. The Lord be with you. The Lord be with me. And that is assurance that we must carry also. I mean, sometimes adversity would cause us, you know, to be isolated. May cause us to have to endure very, very difficult times. But yet, the assurance and the promise that goes alongside with us is the fact that God will never leave us nor forsake us. And constantly we see that that is the assurance that, you know, God's people can give to one another. That was the words of Moses as he passed by the leadership of the people of Israel to Joshua. And he said the similar thing. He says, be strong and of good courage. Be not afraid. The Lord is with you. The Lord goes with you. He will not fail you nor forsake you. And similarly now, as they have these departing words, and Joshua is saying to David, we may never see each other again. And the next time we meet, perhaps you are now king. But the Lord be with us. The Lord be between you and me. And the Lord will not leave us. The Lord will not forsake us. And God is ever with us. And that was the final words that he had with his friends. And he says, yes, the Lord be with us and in the generations that follow. May our houses both continue to be faithful. In a sense, that is what he's saying, because that is what will enable him to keep and maintain that covenant. That even though Jonathan is saying, I will leave and I will depart, and my house, right, the house of Saul will forever be in shame because of what Saul has done, but you, the house of David, will remain. And may that promise be between you and my seed, your seed and my seed, that we will always continue to have that tie in the bonds of Christ. That's what he was saying to his friend as they bid that final farewell. And so for us, as we consider, you know, this whole relationship and everything that was happening with David and Jonathan, you know, we see this pair in deep affliction, in deep trouble, adversity, hardship that they are going through. It was a painful time, but yet what we see is both of them recognizing God's presence in their lives, that God was with them. And because of that, that is what enabled them to weather through this hard and difficult time. And that is what faith will bring for us as well. Whatever it is that we are going through, whatever hardship that we experience, never lose sight of God. Because the moment we lose sight of God, it is easy to be overwhelmed by everything that is happening. But we must look to the Savior and to know that no matter what happens, God is with us. He will never leave us nor forsake us. Let's turn to the Lord in prayer. Our gracious, loving, heavenly Father, we thank Thee for Thy word. We thank Thee for Thy promise. We thank Thee for the assurance that we can have through Thy promises toward us, that Thou hast promised that Thou will never leave us nor forsake us. Help us then to recognize Thy hand working in our lives. No matter what it is that man can do against us, we trust in Thee. And so we pray that Thou bless us, protect us, guide us, and draw us nigh unto Thyself. In Jesus' most blessed name we pray. Amen.